From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. It's Here and Now. The split screens are remarkable today. President Trump in Vietnam meeting with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, while his one-time lawyer and personal fixer Michael Cohen testifies to Congress calling Trump, quote, a racist, a con man, and a cheat. Cohen today claimed President Trump knew beforehand about the WikiLeaks release of hacked Democratic Party emails in the 2016 campaign, and that Trump implicitly directed Cohen to lie about his business dealings in Russia. The fireworks started right away. Jim Jordan, the ranking Republican on the House Oversight Committee, clashed with Chairman Elijah Cummings, claiming the committee members hadn't received Cohen's prepared remarks and documents 24 hours in advance.
You know who had this material before all the members of the committee?
Excuse me.
CNN had it before we did. CNN had the exhibits before we did.
Joining us now is Tim Mak, who covers national security and politics for NPR. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
So what are we learning today that's really new, that Trump knew in advance about the WikiLeaks drop or what else?
Well, it's hard to overstate the number of topics that Michael Cohen is testifying on and the significance of them. I mean, there is a lot to unpackage here. Mm-hmm. He's saying that while president, Donald Trump signed a check to reimburse him, Michael Cohen, for a series of hush payments that he made to Stormy Daniels. He's saying also, yes, he knew about the WikiLeaks releases of emails, of Democratic National Committee emails ahead of time. He is saying that Donald Trump as a person has made a lot of bigoted statements in private. And he's also saying that Donald Trump directed and was informed of the Trump Tower in Russia project during the 2016 campaign, was working on that business project as he was running for president.
So we're getting a lot of details filled in about things we had heard about or were alleged. And is he providing documentation as well?
Yes. He has shown in an exhibit in his testimony a check signed by Donald Trump himself, showing that Donald Trump has a relationship or a link to the very crime that Michael Cohen will soon be going to jail for.
Mm. Cohen today said he didn't have direct evidence of President Trump colluding with Russians. Democrat Debbie Wasserman Schultz pressed him on that.
And he will do what is necessary with the
urge to
win.
And in your opinion and experience, would he have the potential to cooperate or collude with a foreign power to win the presidency at all costs?
Yes.
Tim, what did Cohen say, what else did he say really about the 2016 campaign and election?
One of the big questions of the 2016 campaign was, did Donald Trump have foreknowledge of the coming WikiLeaks release of hacked DNC emails? Michael Cohen now says yes. Michael Cohen also says that during that campaign, Trump associate Roger Stone told Donald Trump that these leaks were coming. He also said that there was an ongoing business proposal and possible project between the Trump Organization and Russia, and that Trump knew about it and directed it. All of these answer, in some ways, if truthful, answer these big questions that we've had for years about the Trump campaign and Trump himself.
Yeah, you know, the hush money, the Trump Tower Moscow, the WikiLeaks drop. Cohen is going to jail in part for lying to Congress about the extent of talks about that Trump Tower Moscow project. Republican Paul Gosar called Cohen today a pathological liar.
Right in front of this committee, you conflicted your testimony, sir. You're a pathological liar. You don't know truth from falsehood.
Sir, I'm sorry. Are you referring to me or the president?
Hey, this is my time.
Are you referring to me, sir, or the president?
When I ask you a question, yes. I'll ask for an answer.
Sure.
Tim, have any Republicans really deviated from that GOP line of attack, just calling Cohen, you know, a liar, someone who just can't be trusted?
Republicans have spent much of their time trying to undercut the credibility of Michael Cohen, in particular, like you said, calling him a liar. But what they've spent almost no time doing is trying to undercut his allegations, in particular, whether there are some problems with the documentation he's put forward. They've gone personal with Michael Cohen, but they haven't really addressed some of the allegations he's made or the documentation he's provided to back it up.
They're not really responding substantively to the documentation or to his allegations.
Right. There have been no questions, as far as I can recall, about the checks that were signed by Trump. Sorry, the one check that was signed by Trump, which Michael Cohen has put forward as evidence. What's clearly becoming a pattern is Democrats are asking questions about testimony. Republicans are asking questions about his character.
Extraordinary Day on Capitol Hill. Tim Mak covers national security and politics for NPR. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks a lot.
As Michael Cohen testifies on Capitol Hill, President Trump is in Vietnam for round two of nuclear talks with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The two men smiled and shook hands, posing for photos in front of a row of American and North Korean flags today. President Trump said he thinks this summit will build on the first, which was last June in Singapore. Here and now, security analyst Jim Walsh joins me now. He's with the MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, hi.
Good to see you, Peter.
Good to see you. Big cloud hanging over this summit is whether the president will be distracted in these negotiations by what's happening on Capitol Hill today with the testimony of Michael Cohen. Legitimate concern?
Well, gosh, I hope not. I assume that would put him in a foul mood and could, in theory, have some impact on the negotiations that are taking place there. My guess is that there'll be enough to do in Hanoi in meetings, in ceremonies, meeting with top aides, that hopefully that won't be too much of a problem.
Well, some people are concerned that the president will be tempted to offer concessions to North Korea, for example, a deal to end the war, just to distract from what's happening in Washington.
Yeah, you know, I can't really comment on what is going on in his head. Is that possible? I guess it is possible. You know, I hope it's not true. The way I've characterized what we might expect coming out of Hanoi, I think the most likely scenario is one where we have a series of modest steps, changes in declaratory policy. You know, we get up and we pledge to do this or we promise to do that. And then some smaller actions around the fringes that begin the process forward. I don't think we're going to have a big detailed plan because the parties haven't been meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the U.S. Special Representative to North Korea only met his counterpart within the last month. And if you remember the Iran negotiations, they took 2 years of intense, you know, weekly, monthly negotiation with working groups. And, you know, none of that's happened. So I don't expect big detailed agreements. I expect declarations and small stuff. But to your question, there is also the possibility that when you get those two guys in the room, they may just go off on their own based on instinct, in the case of the president, and go do something that's more sweeping.
The president has said that he's not backing away from this goal of getting Kim to give up his nuclear program. Can he still do that? You mentioned the step-by-step process where they slowly get there, but do you think it's realistic that they really can?
Well, I don't think we should prejudge the outcome. If we walk into this thinking it's not going to work, then no one's going to make the hard decisions required to make it work. And so it seems to me what you do is you put your head down and you, you know, work away at the thing that's right in front of you, which I think is probably shutting down their plutonium reactor and having that verified in some manner, preferably with people from IAEA, and then you move on to the next thing. And then hopefully you wake up one day and you're done.
Mm.
But I'm not going to get all skittish about the end before I've even started.
One of the things that's interesting to me is the setting. President Trump is clearly trying to use Vietnam as an example of what North Korea could be if it chooses to comply in these negotiations. Is that a convincing message that North Korea could become like this booming country, Vietnam?
Well, I think it's an attractive message. I think it makes it more attractive that you have an example, you know, that a meeting's being held in what would be, you know, case exhibit A for that sort of thing. But I think the president and others need to be reminded countries make decisions not only based on economic policy, but first and foremost, their national security.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I offer you a ton of cash, but you end up losing power or your, you know, country begins to spiral or you feel vulnerable and defenseless, that's not going to work. So, yes, economic incentives, great. We should use more incentives in foreign policy than we do. But unless we solve the national security piece of this, then it's not going to move forward, especially on a topic like nuclear weapons.
Well, even U.S. intelligence agencies are telling the president that Kim is very unlikely to give up his weapons.
Well, I always say, you know, I haven't done this for 20 years. I never say never when it comes to the North Koreans. I've heard them take every conceivable position. We're going to give them up. We're going to keep them forever. Mm-hmm. We won't use them first. We'll use them if you smile at us the wrong way. I've heard everything.
Let's say there is an announcement in the next day or so that both sides will pursue a formal end to the Korean War. Security implications in your mind to that?
Well, I think it's welcome. Again, that's a declaration.
And it's political. It's not official.
Right. And that's different than a peace agreement. So declaring the war is over is a set of words saying we're not fighting anymore. And then ultimately that has to be anchored in some sort of treaty or peace agreement. That's typically what is required. And that's going to have a whole bunch of details that are not going to be worked out. So we're at the point where we're saying it, and words matter. And so I think it's a helpful small step on the way to bigger things.
Jim Walsh, Here and Now security analyst with MIT's Security Studies program. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Games are just kid stuff, right? Just momentary distractions from more important things. Well, no, sometimes they are much more than that. The best games are the definition of nostalgia. They are relics from our past. Gary Wallach from NPR's Only a Game has a story about a guy who has collected a bunch of classic video arcade games to share with people who fondly remember the good old days.
When Gary Vincent was a kid, he and his family spent their summers in Laconia, New Hampshire. There, on the shores of Lake Winnipesaukee, visitors camp, hike, and swim. But Vincent was often found at a 70,000-square-foot indoor entertainment center called Fun Spot. He liked to play the arcade games he couldn't find back home in Connecticut.
Crazy Climber and Alpine Ski. Alpine Ski never really caught on with a lot of people, but I got pretty good at it.
In the summer of 1981, Vincent had just graduated high school. He took a fill-in job as a floor attendant at Fun Spot. He helped customers whose tokens jammed in pinball machines. He handed out prizes at the counter near the row of skee ball games. The job was supposed to last 3 weeks.
And 37 years later, I'm still here.
After a brief stint in college, Vincent took a managerial job at Fun Spot. He didn't enjoy that very much, but business boomed. It was the golden age of the arcade, when customers put their tokens down and waited in long lines for a shot at games like Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, and Frogger. But it didn't last.
83, 84 is the era when the crash occurred.
Affordable home entertainment systems like Intellivision and Atari offered arcade-quality graphics and gameplay. The big, bulky, stand-up consoles were no longer in demand. People stopped showing up.
Anywhere from 75 to 80 to 90% of arcades closed in a very short period of time.
Thousands of Zaxxon, Galaga, Asteroids, and other console games ended up in dumps. But Fun Spot survived. It had a bowling alley, kids' rides, and lots of other attractions. It had ample space to store its big console games, and Vincent had learned how to repair and maintain them. Then in the early 90s, Vincent noticed something funny happening when visitors showed up.
They would see a Defender on the floor or a Pac-Man and say, "Wow, they used to have one of these at the pizza place in town, but they took it out, so I'm so happy you have a few of these games left."
That got visitors asking about other games they remembered. Vincent saw an opportunity.
September of 98 was when I approached the owners at Fun Spot and said, "I want to start a museum."
They said yes. The IRS granted nonprofit status, and the American Classic Arcade Museum was born. Gary Vincent was the curator. At first, he had his doubts.
Where are we going to go with this? Is anyone going to like it? Will there be any interest?
Undeterred, Vincent got to work. The classic games Fun Spot already owned were scattered throughout the massive building, so he shepherded them into their own dedicated 7,000-square-foot room. Then he worked on the atmosphere.
The room is darker than any of the other rooms that are in the building.
And louder. Vincent installed speakers in the ceiling that pump in 70s and 80s music. but Vincent wanted new, or rather old, games to add to the existing collection. He visited trade shows and networked with game enthusiasts. Sometimes the games found him.
Some person will come in and say, hey, cleaning out the garage. My wife says, throw them out. I said, well, don't throw them out. I'll take them.
He found games at yard sales and on eBay. They were in various stages of working order, so Vincent bought old control panels, marquees, and industry-standard 19-inch screens. While juggling his other responsibilities at FunSpot, he found time to hole up in his massive workshop to repair and reconstruct games.
And I'll sit on a cabinet for 10, 15 years trying to find the rest of the pieces to put it back together. And that is always very exciting to me. I don't know why. Most people probably think I'm nuts, but that is what I enjoy.
ACAM now features over 250 classics from the golden age of the arcade game. It's the largest collection in the world, and visitors can play them all. But there was one game in particular that Vincent had his eye on.
I had always wanted a Death Race, and they were hard to find because in 1976, when the game came out, it was very controversial.
In Death Race, the player tries to drive a primitive-looking black-and-white car over pedestrians who scream when they die.
By today's standards, it would be, it's just a game where you run over these stick figures. But back then, it was, it's violent. So a lot of them were pulled from arcades and destroyed.
Very few Death Race consoles survived. But one day, Vincent saw one listed on eBay. It was the only one he'd ever seen, with yellow and black graphics on the cabinet. So he bought it. He was thrilled. Weeks later, the game arrived.
All wrapped in plastic, and we're cutting all the plastic away. And then you'd get that whiff. Mold, mildew, damp, dirt floor, cellar smell. And it just became more overpowering as we cut more of the plastic off. And the smell was horrible.
The fiberboard used on most arcade game cabinets is porous. It picks up odors if stored in areas with moisture.
And animals, big problem. A video game is basically a gigantic mouse condominium. So now I'm starting to think that I have this $1,500 boat anchor, and I moved the whole mess up into the shop, wrapped it in a tarp, and it sat there for a year and a half. And then one day, I had some time, and I said, you know what? It's now or never.
Vincent decided to rebuild the cabinet from scratch.
I posted on one of the game forums what I was doing. So one guy in Florida says, well, I can scan the artwork for you. In the meantime, another gentleman out in Oregon said, I do silk screening. I can make the screens. So he flew in and spent a day in my shop with me putting silk-screened artwork back on that game.
Vincent placed the fully restored Death Race on the ACAM floor. I've played it, and it doesn't smell anymore. It's one of the museum's many gems, including a 1973 version of Pong. And Computer Space, the first commercially available video game, released all the way back in 1970. These days, ACAM is an educational resource for enthusiasts of all sorts, including game club members and students from New England colleges. On my first visit to ACAM, I watched as 200 game design majors from Champlain College arrived on a field trip. They stormed ACAM's aisles like a swarm of aliens from Space Invaders.
And I always enjoy watching that because they've grown up in an era with amazing graphics, sound. Put on the headphones, you're in another world where these games are so old. They are playing games that were made before they were born. Always brings a big smile to my face when you see parents teaching their kids how to play the games they played when they were younger. Yeah, well, here, let me show you, because I was really good at this.
On that first visit to ACAM, I was there with my wife and our son Daniel. He's one of those game design majors from Champlain College. We located some of the games my wife and I played together in our college student union. Dig Dug, Centipede, Millipede, and Q-Bert. My son watched over my shoulder as I guided the cute fuzzy orange Q-Bert away from the bouncing purple snake with the nasty-looking fangs. And I realized something. Daniel is exactly the same age I was when I began playing these games with his mom. I cleared level 3 and leaned in closer to the screen. I couldn't see too well. There was something in my eye.
Oh. Wow. Gary Wallach taking us way back with Dig Dug for NPR's Only a Game. We've got more on the American Classic Arcade Museum at hereandnow.org.
And a woman who dreams of becoming the first female football player in the NFL is making history. You may remember Tony Harris appeared in a Super Bowl ad this month for Toyota.
They said she'd never get to the next level. Never inspire a new generation. Never get a football scholarship.
Well, now Tony Harris has done just that. Yesterday, the 22-year-old Detroit native became the first female football player who's not a kicker to sign a letter of intent for a full football scholarship at a four-year school. She'll be attending Central Methodist University in Missouri. Harris choked up while making the announcement.
I just really appreciate my coaches for it. Sorry. I said I was going to cry.
Harris currently plays defense as a free safety at East Los Angeles College. She's had to overcome several obstacles to get to this point in her football career. She grew up in foster care. She was the first person in her family to graduate from high school and go to college. She's also a cancer survivor. Her ultimate goal is to play for the NFL, and she hopes to inspire others along the way.
If it doesn't happen, then I can just pave the way for another little girl, you know, to come out and play or even start a women's NFL.
Our congratulations today to Tony Harris.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
President Trump's summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Vietnam is also the backdrop for some big business deals. Two Vietnamese airline companies announced agreements with Boeing and General Electric today worth more than $20 billion. The companies will purchase more than 100 Boeing jets as well as engines and other aviation services from GE. And those new planes will help Vietnamese carriers open up travel routes to the U.S. for the first time. For more, let's bring in Seth Kaplan, the editor of Airline Weekly. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Eric.
So Vietjet, is buying 100 Boeing 737 MAX planes. Bamboo Airways is buying 10 Boeing 787s. How big a deal is this for the Boeing Corporation?
You mentioned, Eric, about $20 billion worth of orders. Now, for perspective, Boeing took orders for more than $140 billion worth of planes last year. So this one good day in Vietnam, they sold 14% to these two airlines that most Americans have probably never heard of what they sold all of last year.
Yeah, so it is a big deal. I mean, the 737 MAX that Vietjet is buying is the same new model that spurred some safety concerns, Seth, after it crashed over Jakarta last fall, killing all 189 passengers and crew on board. Is this something of a signal that airlines are now satisfied the plane is safe?
Yeah, Lion Air Flight 610, and that investigation continues. But yeah, you know, this says to me that these airlines, at least, and we're talking here about Vietjet, the one that bought those same models of those 100, by the way, 80, the exact 737 MAX 8 that indeed crashed. This says that they're probably buying the speculation that at least part of the responsibility here was with the airline, Lion Air, with its pilots, and that, you know, whatever role Boeing had, they're confident that it's taking the necessary steps to not have this happen again. It's not the first order that Boeing has gotten for these planes since the crash, but it is the biggest. So I'm sure Boeing is happy to get that behind it.
Vietnam has never operated routes to the U.S. before. Are we going to soon see Vietnamese carriers flying to places like L.A. and Seattle?
Yeah, Vietnam moving from the periphery of the global travel map, kind of a place that's for years intrepid travelers have known, becoming more mainstream. And, that would be a technological innovation, but also a regulatory one. So, you know, first you need the planes that can do it. So those Dreamliners, the 787 Dreamliners that Bamboo has ordered could do it, just as a competing Airbus aircraft like the A350 could do it. But what you also have is just this month, the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, said that Vietnam is safe enough, its airline industry is safe enough to allow airlines to now be able to fly here, as indeed Bamboo seems interested. And the even larger Vietnam Airlines, the flag carrier, has said it too is interested in doing.
Briefly, I want to switch to trains a bit. Amtrak says it may cut some of its routes to focus on the ones that most passengers are on. Do you think this is a good move by Amtrak?
Yeah, focusing more on short-haul routes that compete against airlines in places like the Northeast between New York, Boston, Washington, and against cars in some markets like Chicago, Milwaukee.
Seth Kaplan is editor of Airline Weekly. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We've been following the fireworks today on Capitol Hill, where President Trump's former lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen is testifying in front of the House Oversight and Reform Committee. He called the president a racist, a con man, and a cheat. But Cohen's credibility has also been an issue today. He was, after all, convicted of lying to Congress, and he's going to prison in May. Republican Congressman Jim Jordan also accused Cohen today of being dishonest in the documents that he presented to the committee.
Mr. Cohen, I'm going to come back to the question I asked before with regards to your false statement that you submitted to Congress. On here, it was very clear that it asked for contracts with foreign entities over the last 2 years. Have you had any foreign contract with foreign entities, whether it's Novartis or the Korean Airline or Kazakhstan BTA Bank? Your testimony earlier said that you had contracts with them. In fact, you went into detail.
Sir, I believe it talks about lobbying. I did no lobbying. On top of
in
that, they are not government.
I'm not asking about lobbying, Mr. Cohen.
They
I'm
are saying, not government
do you,
agencies.
Do
they
you
are private,
have,
they
do you
are
have
privately
foreign
or publicly
contracts?
Traded companies.
Do you have foreign contracts?
I currently have no foreign
contracts. Did you have foreign contracts over the last 2 years?
Foreign contracts.
Contracts with foreign entities. Did you have contracts? Yes.
Yes.
Why didn't you put them on the form? It says it's a criminal offense to not put them on this form for the last 2 years. Why did you not do that?
Because those foreign companies that you're referring to are not government companies.
It says non-governmental, Mr. Cohen. You signed
it. They're talking about me as being non-governmental.
It says foreign agency. It says foreign contracts. Do you want us to read it to you?
I read it, and it was reviewed by my counsel, and I am a non-government employee. It was not lobbying, and they are not foreign.
This has nothing to do with lobbying. It says it's a criminal offense to not list all your foreign contracts. That's what it says.
Well, then I'm going to take a look at it before I leave.
No, you've heard
it. I will, and hopefully I will amend it prior to leaving, because that's not the way I read your document.
You know, it's just one more example, Mr. Cohen, of your skirting the truth. Okay, I want to ask one other question.
Sir,
one other question, Mr. Cohen. It's my time, not yours. Were you advised, or was your counsel advised, to withhold your written testimony to the latest possible date, as John Dean said last night on CNN?
Was it my what?
Were you advised, or was your counsel advised, to withhold your written testimony to this committee at the latest possible date to get it to this committee at the latest possible date, as John Dean said that he advised you?
We
yes or no?
No. We were.
He never advised you.
John Dean? I've never spoken with John Dean.
Has he spoken to your attorney?
I don't know. I've never spoken
to John
Dean.
Well, ask your attorney. He's right there behind
you. We were working last night till 11, 12 o'clock at night.
You've known that you've been coming for some time.
You may answer the question. Answer the question if you want.
We were working till 11, 12 o'clock last night to finish everything.
So you were writing it last night, Mr. Cohen?
We were
don't give me that bull.
We were making edits all the way through the night.
Congressman Jim Jordan questioning Cohen's credibility. Another big topic of the day has been potential collusion between the president and Russia, something that Cohen has said he has no direct evidence of.
Questions have been raised about whether I know of direct evidence that Mr. Trump or his campaign colluded with Russia. I do not. And I want to be clear. But I have my suspicions. Sometime in the summer of 2017, I read all over the media that there had been a meeting in Trump Tower in June of 2016 involving Don Jr. and others from the campaign with Russians, including a representative of the Russian government, and an email setting up the meeting with the subject line, "Dirt on Hillary Clinton." And something clicked in my mind. I remember being in a room with Mr. Trump, probably in early June of 2016, when something peculiar happened. Don Trump Jr. came into the room and walked behind his father's desk, which in and of itself was unusual. People didn't just walk behind Mr. Trump's desk to talk to him. And I recall Don Jr. leaning over to his father and speaking in a low voice, which I could clearly hear, and saying, "The meeting is all set." And I remember Mr. Trump saying, "Okay, good, let me know." What struck me as I looked back and thought about the exchange between Don Jr. and his father was, first, that Mr. Trump had frequently told me and others that his son Don Jr. had the worst judgment of anyone in the world, and also that Don Jr. would never set up any meeting of significance alone, and certainly not without checking with his father. I also knew that nothing went on in Trump world, especially the campaign, without Mr. Trump's knowledge and approval. So I concluded that Don Jr. was referring to that June 2016 Trump Tower meeting about dirt on Hillary with the Russian representatives when he walked behind his dad's desk that day.
Michael Cohen's role as the president's lawyer also came up. Here's Republican Congressman Thomas Massey of Kentucky.
Mr. Cohen, can you just clarify, did you say that at times you would do what you thought Mr. Trump wanted you to do, not specifically what he told you to do?
At times, yes.
So you just went on your intuition?
I don't know if I would call it intuition as much as I would just say my knowledge of what he wanted, because it happened before, and I knew what he had wanted.
Does a lawyer have a duty to provide his client with good legal advice?
Yes.
Were you a good lawyer to Mr. Trump?
I believe so.
When you arranged a payment to Ms. Clifford, you say in your testimony, I'm going to quote from your testimony, that you did so, quote, without bothering to consider whether that was improper, much less whether it was the right thing to do. You said that, unquote. That's your testimony today. You said you didn't even consider whether it was legal. How could you give your client legal advice when you're not even considering whether it's legal?
I did what I knew Mr. Trump wanted. This conversation with Mr. Trump started.
I didn't ask whether you're a good fixer. I asked whether you were a good lawyer.
Sometimes you have to melt both together. I needed to, at that time, ensure and protect Mr. Trump. And
so,
if I put my, which I'm clearly suffering the penalty of, I clearly
erred
on the side of wrong.
So you feel like, without bothering to consider whether it was proper, much less whether it was the right thing to do, by ignoring any conscience, if you have one, that you were protecting Mr. Trump.
I'm sorry, sir. I don't understand.
You feel that was how to protect, as his lawyer, you feel
that you did a good job. You said you were a good lawyer, right?
That's
Is that
correct.
Being a good lawyer? To not even consider whether it's legal or not?
I didn't work for the campaign. I was working and I was trying to protect Mr. Trump.
About a campaign.
I sat with Mr. Trump, and this goes back all the way to 2011. This wasn't the first scenario with Ms. Daniels.
Let's go back then.
So my point is, this was an ongoing situation. It didn't just start in October.
Please, you have to
let me finish.
Well,
it didn't start in October.
Let me ask
it started
you
many years earlier.
When were you disbarred?
Yesterday, from what I read in the paper.
Yesterday.
Congressman Harley Ruda, a Democrat of California, changed the subject. He wanted to talk about Trump's relationship with Russian mobster Felix Sater, who had an office on the 26th floor of Trump Tower.
And the 26th floor is important. Why?
Because it's Mr. Trump's floor.
So he had an office on the same floor as President Trump.
In fact, his office, when he left, became my office.
And isn't it also true that convicted Russian mobster Sater even had business cards indicating that he was a senior advisor to Donald Trump, as reported by the Washington Post?
Yes.
Did convicted Russian mobster Sater pay rent for his office?
No, he did not.
So, based on those facts, isn't it true that President Trump misled at best, or worse, lied under oath?
Yes.
Michael Cohen on Capitol Hill today. He goes to prison to serve a 3-year sentence in May.
All eyes are on Vietnam as President Trump and North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un meet for their second summit today. Here's Trump speaking as he and Kim met in Vietnam's capital city, Hanoi.
We had a very successful first summit. I felt it was very successful. And some people would like to see it go quicker. I'm satisfied, you're satisfied. We want to be happy with what we're doing. But I thought the first summit was a great success. And I think this one hopefully will be equal or greater than the first.
We're reporting in-depth on the summit elsewhere on the show, but we also want to consider the host country for this historic meeting. Vietnam is a communist country that has friendly relations with its former enemy, the U.S., and it has deep ties with North Korea, too. It's also a country many of us don't know that much about. Joining us now is Lian Hang Nguyen, a professor of history of the U.S. and East Asia at Columbia University. Professor, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
When most Americans hear of Vietnam, they probably think of the war in Vietnam. It's known as the American War. I mean, that conflict still hangs over both countries, but one could argue Vietnam is exercised that ghost a little better than America. What's your sense?
I definitely think that Vietnam has moved past that war in ways that I would say surpasses the United States in terms of the war wounds healing. I mean, if you look demographically, most Vietnamese were born after 1975. And even that generation that did fight in that war, they aren't as active in national conversations as one would see in the United States.
Vietnam is still a communist country, of course, but like China, it has opened itself up economically. The party, though, is still firmly in control. How hands-off is the Communist Party when it comes to the economy?
That's a good question. And here I would actually say, in certain ways, Vietnam hasn't moved past that war or even the Cold War. In certain ways, the Communist Party still has to sort of grapple with some of the issues of the Cold War period. And in one way, that is to sort of seek legitimacy and have tight control over the economy that is a result of how Vietnam sort of emerged out of the Cold War.
Hmm. I mean, Vietnam still has a ways to go when it comes to freedom of the press, freedom of expression, and other fundamental rights. Has Vietnam made strides in those areas in recent years or not?
I would say not. I would say economically, Vietnam moved towards liberalization. I mean, 1986 saw them enact Noi Mới, which is economic renovation policies. Now, what was supposed to come with that was also social reform, and that did not make the same sort of inroads as economic reforms.
Hmm. Vietnam was once split, of course, between North and South from 1954 to 1975, and North Korea is now separate from South Korea. Explain the relationship between North Korea and Vietnam. I mean, the U.S. wants North Korea to sort of see Vietnam as something of a model. Are there signs that the North is looking at it that way at all?
They are, I think. I mean, this is quite evident in the North Korean leadership and Kim Jong-un's decision to actually stay a few days after the summit. But for a while now, North Korea has looked at Vietnam's path of development as a viable way forward.
You're originally from Vietnam. What do you think are the biggest misconceptions about your country of origin today?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it gets back to the question that we first started with, which was, you know, has Vietnam moved on from the war? And it's always one that catches me because I want to say both yes and no. I think it's very important to understand how the geopolitical winds really affect Vietnam. And in that way, it's something that really harkens back to its history from, I would say, the pre-modern era onwards to the contemporary period, which is that Vietnam rarely stands apart.
For an American visiting Vietnam today, what might he or she be surprised at? How much the war doesn't hang over everything? What?
I would say that if you were to arrive in Vietnam not knowing much of the country, I think what would strike you is just the movement. Everyone is moving. Everything is changing. It's a very exciting time to be in Vietnam. In many ways, even though Vietnam had moved out of this sort of position of marginalization, alienation on the world stage after the third Indochina War, I would say that the sort of integration with the rest of global society, with globalization in general, I mean, you can actually see that take place by just arriving in Vietnam, standing still and watching everything take place around you.
Vietnam hosting this summit between the U.S. and North Korea, how big of a moment is it for the country?
Oh, I think it is very big. I mean, following up on the Kim Trump summit in Singapore, I mean, to host the summit in many ways sort of symbolically represents Vietnam's integration into global society, or really marks its kind of, you know, coming of age moment on the world stage, that now Vietnam has fully arrived as an important player on the world stage.
That's Leanne Hang Nguyen, a professor of U.S. and East Asia history at Columbia University. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR News and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.